Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Rowley.
Rowley here and happy to be here.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
That concludes roll call.
Very well. With 19 members present, we do have a quorum. We typically adopt the minutes. I just want to make sure that we do have the minutes before us. And so that's a question to the clerk.
Yes, the minutes were sent out this morning.
Okay, very well. Thank you. I'm wondering if Representative Mueller would be so kind as to move the January 19th minutes of this committee.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mueller moves adoption of the minutes of January 19th. Discussion? Okay, we'll take a voice vote on this. All in favor of adoption of the January 19th minutes, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of January 19th, 2020 are adopted. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Members, today we won't be moving bills, but we will be hearing some important testimony in regards to police accountability issues and legislation and the intersect of human rights with such legislation. Those of you who were part of this committee last year know that we spent quite a bit of time prior and through the interim in constructing a police accountability bill that eventually was signed into law in late summer, early fall of last year. And so I want the committee to spend some time hearing about that work, as well as, excuse me, to hear from our Peace Officer Standards and Training Board on police reform efforts. Much of that legislation that we passed directed and reinforced, both directed and reinforced the work that the Post had been engaged in and was asked to do some more work. We will have public testimony. We have three individuals lined up at this point for testimony. So the very first part, members, there is a PowerPoint slide, and I think it'd be appropriate for whoever's in control of our slides to do a share screen of that and pop that up there. And that would be our committee administrator, Jamel Lundy. So members, I'm going to walk through this. I'll do it very quickly because I really want us to have the conversation, particularly with the Pulse Board and with our public testifiers. So I'll move through this rather expeditiously. So next slide, we'll have an overview about the events that happened in Minnesota, the killing of George Floyd, in particular that led to the legislation that we eventually passed and had signed. So I want to talk about what those legislative responses were prior and post. and then to identify some of the work that remains that will be the topic of legislation going forward through the course of the rest of the session. So let's move on to the next slide. I think it's really important to understand that before the events of May 25th of 2020, a number of us knew that we had a problem and a challenge in our state in regards to police-community relations, and that, quite frankly, that awareness had been captured in one way or the other for over four decades. And so the following two slides are actually repeats of information that we had shared with the committee back in 2019 as we moved to pass a bill in response to that. And in that slide from 2 years ago, we identified a list, a long list of government, Minnesota state government reports that pointed directly to the issue. Examples of that are listed here, the Council on Black Minnesotans capturing the racial disparity dynamics of African Americans incarcerated in Minnesota, a post-board study in 1991, my very first legislative session as a freshman legislator, of the study of deadly force by police officers, Minnesota planning report on community crime projects and studies and preliminary measures for advancing community policing work in 1996. The Pulse Board itself reporting to the Minnesota legislature on fifth degree assault and domestic abuse by peace officers during the reporting period of 95 through 96. Another report from the Board on Community Policing in 97, and a Department of Public Safety report to the legislature responding to the calls involving emotional crisis and mental illness issues, including policing involvement with that, and creating model program pilot projects in 2002. In 2016, just a little over 4 years ago, the Star Tribune poll found that 6 in 10 Black Minnesotans believe that police are more likely to use deadly force against a Black person than someone who is white. Among white Minnesotans, 28% felt that police were more likely to use deadly force against Blacks. So members, there's both a perception issue as well as a data issue. That challenges the good people of Minnesota that unfortunately diverges along racial lines relative to this issue of police-community dynamics and relationships. The Governor's Council on Law Enforcement and Community Relations in 2017 said, quote, although the lack of trust between law enforcement and community members is sometimes perceived as a metro issue, demographic shifts indicate that communities of color, one of the groups at the forefront of this conversation, can be found in increasing numbers throughout the state. So at that point, and again, this is a slide from 2 years ago for, I believe it was House File 2709 that I authored, that we debated extensively in this committee, in Judiciary Committee that became part of the omnibus bill. That we passed out of this committee, that passed off the floor of the House and went into conference committee. We stated a number of reasons why the bill was needed. The Hennepin County Attorney's 2010 office report on the allegations of misconduct involving the Metro Gang Strike Force, DPS's Office of Justice Program's review of the Twin Cities Safe Streets Violent Gang Task Force, and misdeeds and found in that. The Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage annual report, which lifted this issue of police mistrust within the community. Reports from the Department of Justice regarding the maintaining of First Amendment rights and public safety in North Minneapolis. The Governor's Council on Law Enforcement and Community Relations, an initial report in 2017, and their final report later in that year on law enforcement and community relations, and the DPS's Office of Justice Programs report to the legislature on community justice reinvestment account. So members, before we knew his name, this committee had acted to prevent this tragedy of May 25th. In fact, prior to this committee acting, there had been a number of steps moving us steadily in the direction of the importance of addressing the issue of police-community relations, particularly as they fall along racial lines and particularly as they involve police use of force. Collecting misconduct data, and this promoted by the police, I'm sorry, let me back up. So we introduced House File 2709, and in that bill, there were several key features. One was to collect misconduct data to inform policy changes and intervene into problem officers. This is now commonly known as early intervention systems in jurisdictions and states across the nation are both creating and wrestling with this issue and understand the need for the collection of such data in order to create such systems that would allow us to intervene in a timely manner to be able to hopefully prevent misuse of force, including that leads to death, and to be able to assist our professional peace officers in terms of adjusting their practices accordingly. The bill also granted citizens the power to enact policy changes. This is eventually what becomes the Citizens Relations Council. And the understanding was that, or rather the learning, was that whether it's in public safety or any other entity or any other activity of government, that unfortunately one of the loopholes as we construct public policy is not addressing the need for our licensing bodies, our regulatory bodies, our accountability bodies to actually respond to those citizen dynamics that we create. Granting citizens a seat in the Complaint Investigation Committee in the post, and then spending $6 million to extend police training funds. And members, this is really important. I won't go into detail, but there is a training account in the post board that was modernized and authorized for state investment in police training following the killing the police killing of Philando Castile in the East Metro. Those funds had been, and actually are still sunsetted. And so the posture of this committee, of this body, was to continue to make investments in appropriate police training. In other words, to invest in our public safety officials, but to do so conditional on the necessary reform that four decades of study was pointing us and begging us to do. And so that was the dynamic of the House File 2709 in 2019. George Floyd, then that bill was not accepted, if you will, from the other body. In fact, no hearings were held in the other body on any of these issues, much less this bill. And so there was no success in moving any provisions that we have worked hard on to do. And the sunset then therefore continued on the police training dollars. A year later, a little less than a year later, in May, George Floyd is killed by Minneapolis police officer. That then generated an immense reaction. I don't have to recount for you first here in Minneapolis. So Minnesota clearly had a very visible and visceral reaction that cut across all sorts of communities in the state of Minnesota. That was also then mirrored across the nation and indeed across the world, where massive demonstrations were found in major cities across both European nations, but also nations in other parts of the world. We immediately began to take legislative action. And I mean immediately. The night I heard of the killing on May 25th, I was in immediate communication with our House research staff here with other colleagues to reconstruct the House File 2709 that we had passed the year before, that we had attempted to remove or to move during 2020. And then, like much of good public policy, we were waylaid with the COVID pandemic. And so we constructed in this committee and then in partnership with the Posse Caucus of this House, the Minnesota Police Accountability Act, which had three major chapters: the Reclaiming Community Oversight Act, that looked at civil law and regulatory reforms, the Reforming Accountability Act, which looked at criminal justice reforms, and the Reimagining Public Safety Act, which moved for structural reform. So, this committee took, along with our Posse Caucus colleagues, took a big systemic step to address this issue, again, not out of thin air, but out of 40 years of studies, reflections, and calls to action. The first part of that was the Reclaiming Community Oversight Act. I'll go through it very quickly. I'll do the next slide there. It had a number of provisions, including bars on certain types of peace officer restrictive procedures, particularly the use commonly known as the use of chokeholds. There was a requirement for peace officers to intercede when another officer is using excessive force and report that incident to the CLIO of the agency. We know that there were four officers involved in George Floyd's death, with one involved in direct restrictions, physical restrictions of the other of George. With the other individuals playing different roles in that. A banning of the warrior style training, the requirement of the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board to establish a 15-member community police community relations council that would, as I said earlier, collect and analyze misconduct data to make disciplinary and policy recommendations, again, commonly referred to as early warning systems. Requiring each local unit of government, of governing body that oversees a law enforcement agency, to establish a citizen oversight council. So reintroducing the role of citizens in reviewing the conduct and outcomes of police community interactions, and then allowing cities or counties to impose a residency requirement. The second part of that act was the Reforming Accountability Act. This had some pretty technical and complicated pieces related to the use of deadly force and clarifying the conditions under which those would be used. And so there were certain standards were identified that would be reinforceable, by law in terms of the conditions that a peace officer is responding to at that time. It would have given the Attorney General's office jurisdiction to prosecute cases When peace officers are alleged to have caused an officer-involved death, there was the elimination of the need for cash bail for those charged with misdemeanor offenses other than domestic assault and some driving under while intoxication of violations. There was a creation successfully done of an independent use of force investigations unit within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to investigate officer-involved deaths. And so the emphasis was on the creation of an independent walled-off unit that can reinforce the public's trust of the objectivity of the investigators. And then requiring an officer who takes a child into custody to communicate with or take the child to a juvenile secure detention center to determine whether the child should be released or detained using a risk assessment tool. The final part of that major legislative proposal was the Reimagining Public Safety Act, which would have established the position of a community-led public safety coordinator at the Department of Public Safety's Office of Justice Programs. There was a provision to restore the voting rights of convicted felons immediately upon their release from prison, the establishment of an officer-involved death review board in the Department of Public Safety, the creation of critical incident stress management teams for emergency service providers to be able to consult and receive assistance in stress management, establishing the standards for crisis intervention and mental illness crisis training for peace officers, requiring the development and implementation of autism training for peace officers, and requiring officers whose use of force results in injury or death to file a report to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It was a big bill, members. It was an important bill. It was heavily engaged with the public and went through many hours of development work drawing from previous efforts on the part of the legislature. A compromise was eventually reached after several special sessions in House File 1 in, I forget which one, was it the fourth special session late in August. House File 1 was passed into law that included the critical incident stress management teams and public safety peer counseling, a recognition that there are human beings that work in our public safety work, and that being able to, and recognizing the stress and the trauma that they face and how that relates directly, often tragically, to use of force outcomes. And so providing interventions and supports for that. There was the investigatory reform I mentioned with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. There was a element of police residency reform. There was an element of banning chokeholds and certain neck restraints. There was some reform on the use of force and on the use of force reporting. There was a peace officer training assistance funding extension, post board reform and citizen engagement. This was critically important as it introduced a strong presence of citizens within, not to replace the post board itself, but within the post board that the post board could not ignore by legislative statutory language. It was the prohibition of warrior-style training, post board model policies were called for. Mental health and crisis intervention training was deepened and mandatory, as well as mandatory autism training. Members, it's my contention, it's a contention, we'll hear testimony later, that much work, as important as all this work was, and in the end, we had a bipartisan agreement in both houses, but that much work still remains. There are still authority issues that need to be strengthened, talked through and strengthened relative to the Citizen Oversight Council at the Pulse Board. We didn't touch the body camera issue. That had been a topic in previous years. It's technically a very difficult issue and one that raises a number of resource allocation issues. Nonetheless, one that needs to be addressed and has been addressed to some degree in other states. There's complaint data classification. Any early warning system can only be as good as the data that's collected. There are data privacy issues that both enhance and get in the way of being able to construct an effective database, not for the purpose of, you know, hounding peace officers, but for the purpose of having a truly strongly informed early warning system, and that the professionals can then use that data to intervene effectively. There are other issues, the use of informants in custody. Yesterday, our new president named the issue of white supremacy as something that endangers our democracy, our nation, and called for an end to it. We know, we've heard testimony in this committee, that public safety is not immune to the presence of white supremacy. We know that's true in our military. Our pending secretary for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified, this is a retired general, that he thinks it's a vital, important national and domestic security issue to be able to root out white supremacy from our armed forces. I would submit that I think it's important that we do that with all our public agents, including our public safety agents. There's work still to be done on promoting police co-responder models. There's a great interest on the part of the public to step up, work with and co-own the administration of public safety with their peace officers. We of late have learned that there are new arbitration issues that have been raised as a result of our legislation that needs to be addressed. There is ongoing need for protections for both officers and those in custody. There's ongoing need for adequate training and funding. And then there's the unaddressed duty to intervene and report, and so much more. And so members, to close, the work that remains in many ways should not be approached from, pick a couple of issues here and there and don't necessarily connect the dots. We are talking about a system. We created a system of public safety. That's our wisdom as Minnesotans. And it was meant to be able to reinforce, its different elements in order to meet our core commitment of making sure that people can be, in fact, safe in our society. That calls for all sorts of collaboration, collective action across the state at different levels of governance. That same approach needs to be done, not just for the immediate delivery of safety, I would submit, but for also the ever-focused attention to guarantee the human and civil rights of every resident in the state of Minnesota, and to really center policing in a manner that is consistent with those rights and that enjoys the confidence of our citizenry. And so there are a number of issues that I'll be bringing and others will be bringing forward relative to human rights and governance and public safety. And with that, I'm going to stop express my appreciation for allowing the chair to walk through that. I thought it was important for me to do it. I also thought it'd be effective for me to walk through that as opposed to just turning the staff to do that. And so at this point, I would certainly entertain any discussion, whether it's in the form of questions or just, members with each other for just a few minutes, because I really want us to move over to the Pulse Board for their important presentation and then to make sure we have time for the public testimony before us. So let me pull up my participants list, and I see the representative, Vice Chair Fraser, has a question and or comment.
Thank you, Chair. Probably more so just statements, and I'll try to be brief. But initially, I want to thank you, the rest of the Posse Caucus, and then specifically Representative Moran. I'm glad that you mentioned or you noted that this work has been years in the making. It wasn't just from the result of the murder of George Floyd, but in fact, it's from events that have happened over the course of many years, not only in our state of Minnesota, but also in our country. And to that point, I want to say that was good work that was done. I will acknowledge that. That was good work that was done in a special session in light of everything that was happening. I'm glad there was bipartisan support to move the legislation forward. And I think this work should always be bipartisan. Because, in fact, I think it's nonpartisan. I think these issues that are facing our state, that are facing our country, these are issues that impact everyone. And these are issues that, as elected officials, we should be making sure that we lend our voice and our support behind to provide a public safety system that is exactly that, safe for everyone. There should not be a concern that if I call, particularly I'll speak as a Black man, if I call a police officer, I should not have the concern that there may be harm done to my body or to my family. And I have really good relationships with the officers, particularly in my area. I've had good relationships with officers throughout my life, but I've also had some interactions that have been very, very traumatic. And speaking to those interactions, that just should not happen. It should not happen in our state. It should not happen in our communities at all. So I'm looking forward to continuing this work and hopefully being joined by all of my colleagues on this committee to push things forward and to strengthen the Accountability Act that was passed in the special session as we move forward. I got to tell you, from my community, and this is across all racial lines, they want to see more accountability from officers that violate that sacred oath to protect and serve. They want to see that. They want to see more community input to be a part of decisions that are being made around the training, around actions that are being taken for officers' accountability. They want to see any forms of white supremacy or extremism. They want to see it pushed out of the system. They don't believe that it's something that is beneficial. And in fact, and they absolutely know that it's something that is harmful. And I think more than anything, the events that we saw in our Capitol, as more information is starting to come out, we see, and I think we absolutely know how harmful and how dangerous it is for this white supremacy to not be rooted out of our systems. And if there's any one place that I believe is most dangerous, it's in our law enforcement. They are given a task to protect and serve. They have access to some of the most vital data about ourselves as individuals in our communities. And so we have to make sure that those are individuals that are truly in that position to protect and serve and not to do any harm. I wanted to make it brief, so I'll stop there, but I just wanted to add, I'm appreciative of the work that was done, and I'm very happy to be a part of this team to move forward and strengthen things as we're going forward.
Thank you, Representative Fraser. You know, I've said before, and I'll say it again, you know, that it's precisely those that we have high expectations of that we strive to create high-quality, objective accountability systems for. If I have no expectations of you, you know, I don't even know why I would bother, you know, with accountability efforts. It's the mark of a civilization, of a civilized civilization, that we create those type of systems in order to honor the high expectations we have of one another. And the standard is high for those who are public agents, particularly those who have been granted the ability to use force, because there are times when that is necessary. And so I will say that it'd be one thing if this committee, this body, this legislature was starting from scratch, but we're not. We have a rich body of data, of social science, of political goodwill, of experiences, good and bad, to be able to draw from. You know, one of the weaknesses, if you will, I believe, of any democracy is that any one of us can be out of here, you know, the next term. We either just, you know, we leave or we're booted out. There's something good about that because there's a rejuvenation, if you will, of new experiences and new ideas that come through. But on the downside, there's the loss of wisdom relative to, in this case, 40 years of studies. And if we're not spending time as a body looking at that and building upon that, then we simply leave the next iteration of the legislature to start all over again. This is way too important for us to, quote unquote, start all over again. We really need to build on the wisdom that we steadily attain and acquire from all sectors, including in this case for our public safety officials and as well as increasingly aware community members. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I think I'm just echoing the same sentiments that you stated. My community in particular, we're right on the border of where Philando Castile was killed. And it has hurt our community deeply to feel like law enforcement, and in particular our elected officials, are being reactionary as opposed to proactive. And in that way, I'm really heartened by all the work that's been done over the past year. And I would just encourage everybody on this committee to consider not acting as a reactionary moment, but instead be proactive in what we are doing to commit to safety for all of our communities and all of our community members. It is something that is paramount to our civilization, and we absolutely must be committed to this. And to echo your sentiments, Representative Frazier, this is not a partisan issue. This is not a race-based issue. This needs to be a nonpartisan issue, and this affects literally everybody. Statistically, more white people are killed by police officers than people of color in the state of Minnesota. And so we have to demand accountability for all of the people of Minnesota, because I want to make sure that everybody's children feel free and that every person feels like they can call on their police officers when they need to in times of emergency and not risk being harmed. So thank you so much for all this important work. I really look forward to continuing it on.
There's much work for us to do together, Representative Hollins, and preferably we could do that in a strong, application of objective science across the aisle with one another. Representative Johnson, and then we'll move on to the next part of the agenda today. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I know it was a lot of work with what we got passed last, during that, I believe it was the first special session on some of this reforms. Unfortunately, there were some issues in that bill that I had concerns about, and it was actually brought up last year. Some of the concerns were addressed by a KSTP TV story. Where earlier this month that the state is having trouble getting arbitrators to do just the law enforcement only complaints for disciplinary procedures. And the reason for that is there's actually very, very few that go to the arbitrators for disciplinary issues. They've been, they started trying to get the arbitrators for that in June, and I think they only have two at this time. And so it's an issue. There's so few actual legitimate complaints that go to the arbitrator that they can't even fill the six spots. And that's because the vast majority of the time, either the complaint is unfounded, or if there is disciplinary action, the officer accepts that discipline. And so they do not go to the arbitrators, just because the officers usually take responsibility, especially when the discipline is fair. And so I don't know, that's an issue we're gonna have to deal with. And also in the changes to the use of force, requiring a peace officer to give a testimony or a statement, that might conflict with his constitutional rights, not only as a citizen, but as a police officer. So that's another issue that we're going to have to look at, because I don't think, and I do believe if an officer took that to court for a termination or any, because he refused to give a statement, he would win that hands down, because he has not only his Fifth Amendment rights, he also has the Tennyson issues as well, whereas to do that statement.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I do think that there is much, you know, it's not unusual. I've been here a long time, so have you, that we'll pass legislation and then a little while down the road, sometimes sooner than later, we're needing to adjust, fix, as we continue to learn in the application of legislation. And so I do look forward to working with you on those particular issues as well.
I agree with that. There's a couple other things I wanted to mention that in your slide presentation, you talked about the, if I can get it back up on my screen here, gang task force issue in 2010 when that report was done. I was actually an officer back then, and we agreed there was an issue there that needed to be taken place. And also on the, trying to remember the other one here, the violent gangs task force in 2011 when that report was done. We're talking over a decade ago, and those issues have been handled. I was an officer then, and what happened was wrong. It was taken care of. And I'm getting a little disenfranchised with issues being brought up from decades ago that have been addressed. What's going on now? The only thing that we've had as far as riots, with Representative Frazier brought up with the unfortunate incident on that I totally believe is 100% wrong, as what happened to the U.S. Capitol. But we've had these things going on since 4 years. In fact, last night they were rioting in Portland because one side, I'm not going to say which side, didn't believe that Biden was going far enough with his executive orders. We need to condemn all violence, whether it's the rioters or if the officers are making poor decisions and using excessive force. But we need to stop doing this and inflammatory and inflaming things. We need to discuss it in a rational way, looking at both sides of the issue.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. It sounds to me like you and I probably agree more than disagree. Violence and destruction in any form is something that as good moral citizens, much less as public officials, we simply cannot condone. I am going to move forward, but I would take issue with the notion that past reforms or past issues have been totally effectively dealt with. That didn't do George Floyd any good on May 25th, that we took care of, quote unquote, took care of, the issues related to the gang strike force. There were behaviors and cultures that continue, in my belief, out of sight and without an accountability system from which those activities sprang from. And I believe that it's that kind of stuff that continues to manifest itself before us. The purpose of the presentation was not to revisit the gang strike force issue as much as to get the point across that these issues don't come out of nowhere, that we built a system and we can redesign that system so that we're not constantly reacting to people within it who abuse it. So that's really the point of that.
I agree with you on that.
Representative Johnson, we're going to move forward.
One last statement, please.
In the discussion, we will continue it. We got lots of committee hearings before us. Members,
I agree, but I'm getting tired of pushing stuff from Minneapolis where the issues occurring and lack of ability of the city council to do their duty.
Johnson, come on. Don't have me call you out of order. Come on. I'm going to ask the Post Board to come forward, Post Board Executive Director Eric Missel, and our Post Board Chair, Chief Kelly McCarthy. Please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I'm going to give just a brief introduction, and then Executive Director Missel will go into detail with some of the changes that we're making in the Post Board.
Welcome.
When I was first appointed to the Post Board, I was surprised that it was the Post itself was designed to take a back seat to local control, where other regulatory boards are usually the standard. We're really designed to support the local agency. The need has changed, and we failed to change with it. And so what we're trying to do now is we're trying to take apart the car and rebuild it while we're still driving down the freeway. And we're working very, very hard to do that. We also recognize that the commitment to equal justice, there needs to be an urgency, and we have to attack this with the urgency that people's lives require. But when it comes to the policy and the changes, we have to slow down and be very, very diligent. There is so many great police officers in the state doing great work day in and day out. And while it is occasionally disheartening to have conversations like this, we know we're up to the challenge. And too often, before I got to the Post Board, I would hear people say, well, where are all the good officers? You hear from the figureheads of unions and whatnot, but what do the good officers have to say? And so Post, we're really trying to make sure that all of our decisions emphasize and elevate those cops out there that are doing great work and are meeting the needs of their community. And we're going to continue to do that. So I think a good example of that is, I mean, we're in uncharted waters here for the Post Board. But an example of that is after the killing of George Floyd, we released a statement, and that ruffled a lot of feathers. It certainly ruffled a lot of feathers in the law enforcement establishment because the Post Board had never done anything like that before. But we understood that this was a different situation, and we understood that the public needed to know that that was not how we trained our officers. They needed that reassurance that this was an outlier and not standard practice. And so we went ahead and did that, and we took some heat for it, but I still believe that it was the right thing to do, and we're not afraid of a fight. And so with that, we'll have Director Missel go into all the real deep changes that we're doing at the Post Board.
Thank you, Chair McCarthy. I look forward to continue our work with you on this important matter. Director Missel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to come before you again. And I apologize, some of this may sound reminiscent of what we talked about just last week, but I think I'll be able to put a little more flesh in the bones for you. And just a heads up, because as we experienced with my internet here at the office, if I start to get glitchy or something, I will turn off my video so I can stay on.
Oh, good.
Just a quick commentary on some of the things before I get into the meat of what I wanted to cover, or I shouldn't say commentary, but a quick update with regard to, I was reminded as you were going through the legislation, Mr. Chair, that there are a number of things that we did have already accomplished and put to bed, so to speak. Primarily, the use of force policy has been disseminated to all the agencies. They've reported back, supplied those copies back to us. The learning objectives for use of force because of the changes to 609.066 and others have been updated, as well as the creation of autism learning objectives for pre-service and then eventually continuing education. The warrior style training, we've evaluated a number of courses, and we actually had a couple come in that we have rejected as a result of the statute. So I can report that is in place. And then, of course, duty to intercede and report, which just going back to my experience as a police chief is a critical one that is in place as well and part of the policy and part of our mandate. So those are the things that I think are relatively buttoned up at this point. And, of course, we'll continue to update in the future as the environment changes. But so with that, I'll go into some of the initiatives and kind of where we are in progress, so to speak. As I've mentioned, we're undergoing a comprehensive overhaul of our rules, the entire chapter, 6700, which drives much of what the Post Board does. Just for perspective, there are 41 sections in the chapter with numerous subparts that cover basically everything we do, from initial licensing to violations of standards of conduct. Part of the perfect storm of this whole thing, if I put it in that term, in terms of what we've had to address as a board, is that those rules, as an example, have not had any major rulemaking done or updating for at least a decade that I could find. And the last time only dealt with one section, continuing education. So this is a major task that we're undergoing. It involves everything, like I said, across the board, from the initial licensing when someone comes into the system to when they leave. So there's a lot to do there. That is underway. And of course, because nothing operates in a vacuum, that is the changes that will be suggested for rulemaking are directly linked or have to be, quite honestly, to either work by the Community Relations Advisory Council, by the Rules Advisory Committee. We need to take into consideration the audit that was completed and the recommendations in there. So it's really weaving, I think I mentioned it last week, it's really weaving all those together to make sure that they're working in conjunction with each other, not at odds. So one change in one side of the system requires a change in the other. Secondly, the audit, speaking of the audit, that is complete, was completed on time and on schedule in September, October. And we're working on reviewing the details of that and the recommendations and then next steps, again, in the context of rulemaking and also the eventual work once we get a little bit further down the road of the advisory council. Included in that audit, in case you didn't have a chance to read it, was, you know, continuing education. We're looking at how we vet our courses. I think I've mentioned that before. And one of the recommendations was explore a certified instructor program. Some states do that, where you have instructors that go to a unified, they are taught in a unified manner. And then once receiving that certification from the state, they're allowed to then go out and do the training. We do not have that in place right now in Minnesota. Certification, so to speak, of instructors comes from, you know, whatever, if it's a tool, let's say Taser, the vendor Taser is the one who certifies instructors and how to teach the use of that tool. Of course, incorporating it with current use of force policy, but in my mind, there's some space there and part of the for the board to be involved in that. And it certainly fits well with the recommendations of the audit and also the legislation regarding training. And then, of course, development of a list of providers and courses. Some of this, just so the committee is aware, some of the stuff with regard to training is a little bit back burner right at the moment because we are primarily focused on the database and building that. And we have that drop dead deadline of July 1st. So much of the training will come into play in the second half of 2021. So we can meet the future deadlines on that. But it's all happening at the same time, and we can walk and chew gum. It's just how fast we can walk while we're chewing the gum. That's with continuing education. Pre-service education right now, I think I mentioned I'm exploring with some academic institutions and possibly other partners to build a new job task analysis. That was, again, part of the IEDLIST recommendations and something we can do right now and really can form the basis for decision-making with regard to training and training curriculum, particularly in pre-service, and that's where it was mentioned. So the idea is that the recommendation, I should say, and our intent is to better define the curriculum for pre-service, define the topics, the amount of time that's spent on it, and maybe even down to the actual outline. That is something that is a little bit more determined by schools right now. We develop broad learning objectives and then they implement the training. I think that has to change. That was clear from the audit, and that's something we will be working on going forward. and is in progress. Finally, in terms of regulatory functions, mandate some minimum background investigation steps. We provided guidelines, and Post has provided guidelines to agencies for some time. And there are some rules in our rules that say, you know, you must do a psychological evaluation that must include an oral interview. But in terms of the background, in terms of, you know, how you do a background, how thorough it is, you know, do you do checks? And I don't want to get down in the weeds necessarily, but do you do a financial records check? You know, do you do a credit check? Are you talking to neighbors? That sort of thing. There are some, it's not new. Tried and true investigative techniques. As a former instructor for background investigations, I know what those are. We don't require that or define that right now for agencies. And I could see part of the recommendation, if we go with the recommendation, would be to perhaps define better what are the minimum standards for conducting a background investigation for police officers when agencies are doing these and looking to hire them. Defining non-criminal conduct better. As the chair is well aware, and I think many of the members of the committee are well aware, we are restricted primarily to criminal convictions in terms of standards of conduct. There are some non-criminal convictions we take action on, but they are limited. And the ones that are there are very broadly defined, such as, general misconduct or a misconduct of a public official. The recommendation, I think, something that would help provide some clarity and transparency to everyone, is including us, is to define better what kind of non-criminal conduct qualifies for licensing sanctions. Because right now, and you know, the white supremacy issue is a good one. As most know that have operated in the profession for some time, or any profession for that matter, membership in a religious group or a group, so, you know, any kind of potential group that you're a member of, where does that then impact your job or your license? People have a right to belong to different things, but of course, obviously, if they're involved with a well-known identified terrorist organization, different story entirely, right? But those are the things that is that kind of conduct, does that rise to the level of requiring licensing sanctions, or is it appropriate for licensing sanctions? So there are some tough questions buried in here, and I don't want to start a whole storm right now. But the fact of the matter is that those are the kind of things that we are going to have to wrestle with as a board and as a profession and as a community going forward. So better defining conduct in terms of licensing sanctions. Articulating the criteria. One of my frustrations here is taking over this position as a fairly new person in the position is understanding in which situations do I order an investigation? In which situations is it left to the local agency? Or we tell the local agency, do an investigation and report back to us. I have the authority, the board has the authority to order an investigation, but clearly you don't want to do that all the time. And there are certain circumstances where we will, definitely will, and in other times where we don't. So better defining that again, from the standpoint of transparency and all of us understanding and being very clear about what things the Post Board will directly investigate and which things they won't, is a critical piece. And part of, I think, some of the misunderstanding of the role of the Post Board, through no fault of the public, but through, you know, it's something we need to define better. We need to clean up our backyard and then present that publicly so people understand better what we do and what we stand for. Very minor recommendation that was brought up, which I think is interesting and something I thought about as an example. And one of the issues that we're considering, again, a change, and it may seem minor, but I think it's important, is that when an officer leaves an agency, right now, we just simply tell the agency, let us know that they've left your agency. If they're going to another agency, what is it? Which one is it? Most employers or particular licensing will ask for the reason for that person to be leaving employment. Was it a voluntary separation? Is it a retirement? Is it a lateral transfer? Or is it resignation in lieu of a resignation for cause, or a resignation in lieu of termination. Those are important things, and another facet where there's a potential catch ball there that maybe is not being caught right now, and is, I think, well within the purview of the post board, arguably. I haven't broached that with anybody, but I think it's part of just indication of what we're looking at in terms of kind of increasing accountability. Just very quickly, with regard to the complaint database, as a result of the reform legislation, I'd mentioned we have...
I have to move very quickly because I'm kind of running out of time. But this
oh,
is,
you're at two. Okay.
Yeah, but this is a vitally important issue, so we'll make sure we come back to this at a future date as well. But yeah, just...
Okay. Okay, I'll wrap up by saying, you know, again, we're juggling a lot of different things. The complaint database is being built as we speak, at several meetings. We still have our target date of July 1 for that to be submitted. As you mentioned, you know, there are issues potentially with the type of data we're collecting. And I guess with deference to Representative Novotny, who's on the advisory council, because I haven't mentioned this to the advisory council, but one of the things I want to do the next meeting we have is talk about tackling a couple of things in the IADLIS audit. And since the council really doesn't have data to work with right now, maybe a good use of getting together and getting moving forward on some of this stuff is to take a couple of those recommendations and provide recommendations to the board, which was, as I understand it, the intent of the council. So with that, I'll cut it off so that you can field questions and whatnot.
Very well. Members, I'm going to do a really hard stop at 2:15. We do have three members here. I have questions, but I'm not going to ask them because I want to make sure other members get their questions in. I will just very briefly say that a director and chair, you know, from my perspective, a breath of fresh air to be able to work with a Pulse board openly and transparently and pulling in the same direction. I suspect we're not always going to agree, but that's fine. I mean, I think the point is that this legislature needs to have the kind of relationship with the Pulse board while respecting its autonomy in the way in which both of you have provided leadership and access for this committee. With that, I'm going to call on Representative Long and then Representative Frazier. We'll cap it off with Representative Lazaro, and it's a hard stop, folks, 2:15. So, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Thank you so much for your good work on following up on the legislation and in general with moving forward on much-needed reform. My question is on the duty to intercede or duty to report. Do those duties only apply for use of force, or do they apply if other illegal activity is observed by officers?
Director Bissell.
That applies to if they observe any use of force, excessive, what they deem as the excessive use of force. I'd have to dig into it deeper, I think, but that is pretty much limited to, I shouldn't say limited, but I guess in the context of your question, yes. Its use of force.
Yeah, I actually don't recall myself. I do believe that's correct, Representative Long.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if it was a sexual harassment or stealing or something else they observed, there would not be a duty to report or duty to intercede.
Not with the use of force policy, which is the context in which this was written. I will say, and I'm sure the chief would agree that you know, most departments will have a set of rules or policies that require reporting of, you know, that other conduct that may not fall under the use of force, you know, heading.
Thank you.
Representative Long, perhaps some work for us to also do that. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. Just quickly, first of all, Chief McCarthy, thank you for those words you said up front. Appreciate that. I, too, as Chair Mariani stated, breath of fresh air to hear that you want to make these changes and you understand there are changes that need to happen. And I can appreciate the fact that you want to be deliberate about that so we do it the right way. Quick question around, I know we're emphasizing collecting data, and this may go to Mr. Missel. Do you believe it will it make sense, or does it make sense, in your estimation, the more data we have, the better we'll be about being preventative in some of these situations that we end up with law enforcement and these bad interactions with community?
Great question. Director Bissell.
Yes, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt as to that. The more information you have, the more, you know, covers a variety of areas, and you can compare data, one set of data to the other, and, you know, create linkages and all that without a doubt. And I was really poor at social research methods in college, but from what I remember, that's a good way to go about it. Yes, I would agree. The catch is always now what data is classified as the chair mentioned, you know, private versus public. Do we want the state, and setting aside the post board for a minute, do we want the state pulling in very confidential internal affairs data from agencies? Maybe we do, but then the question always becomes, and the attorneys will tell you this, okay, now you have it, now you own it, now what are you going to do with it? And then, you know, what liability are you taking on by holding that data? So that's always the balance, but in general, to answer your question is yes, absolutely.
Very, very well. Thank you, Director Misselder. And of course, you know, I've made my posture pretty clear from the beginning. You know, the state has a primary duty to ensure human rights are being met. The state is the primary license issuer. And I totally respect, understand, and even appreciate the local jurisdiction issues for effective public safety. But in this chair's opinion, that cannot come at the expense of our licensing authority and or our commitment to guarantee our constitutional rights to our residents. Representative Lucero, you have the final question or word here, and then we're going to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I always appreciate conversations, while I may not necessarily agree with certain aspects of them. And I wasn't going to say anything, but something that, just since I'm speaking, I'll bring it up. It's just a little bit disappointing that when in your PowerPoint, Mr. Chair, everything in there were, you know, it was a bipartisan effort, the initiatives that were passed last year, but all the pictures in there were Democrats. And we know that this was a bipartisan measure. It would have been nice to at least acknowledge at least, you know, more of the aspects of Republican contributions as part of that in the PowerPoint, in the picture. But the reason I raised my hand here was, Mr. Chair and Mr. Missel, you were kind of mealy-mouthed in regards to white supremacy and then people of faith or religion. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to maybe clarify that, because I was you blew past that, and I want to make sure that you're not equating the repugnant belief system by some of white supremacy with that of people of faith.
Director Missel.
Yep, I think I opened that can of worms, so I better answer for it. Yeah, I was inarticulate in what I said, Representative Lucero. I appreciate you bringing that up. That's not at all what I meant. I just, as a former police chief, I know that there's always that fine line between a person's off-duty conduct or how they represent themselves, whether it's on Facebook or whatever organizations they're part of. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's a religious, a social organization. It doesn't matter. I was not equating the two. I'm just saying there's that fine line between a person's First Amendment rights and rights to freely associate. And then where does potentially that association impact how they're viewed in the job or their employer or that sort of thing? That's all I meant by that. I was not drawing a conclusion between the two. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to square that away.
Yeah, actually,
thank you, Mr. Missel, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you, Representative Sir. I think it was important to give the director an opportunity to clarify that. And I will. And by the way, thanks for your advice. I'll look for Picture for Republicans, and if I ever do another PowerPoint, I think it's maybe my third PowerPoint in 30 years here. But
Mr. Chair, I could happily provide you maybe a picture to add some color if you want some. I've got a little flair we could add.
Yeah, maybe one with that blue hat you've got on, man, which I'm very covetous right now and envious of. you know, I do think that part of, this is me personally, I do think that part of what challenges all of us, I would submit humbly, is perhaps not a deep enough understanding of racial supremacy and its impact on our society and the white supremacist movement, you know, which has been noted in FBI, you know, advisories and concern for quite a while now, is something that we just kind of keep tiptoeing around. And the better we get to understand it, the more we'll, I think, not confuse that with other, you know, important, you know, belief systems that are perfectly acceptable, you know, for a civilization, whereas this is not. So thank you for bringing that up. Members, we're going to move forward then with, we have public testimony from three individuals who are going to be coming forward. I think it's going to be in this order, so let me try this. Angela Myers from the Minneapolis NAACP. Please welcome to the committee, Ms. Myers.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Angela Rose Myers. I am the president of the Minneapolis NAACP, which stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. We are one of the oldest and largest civil rights organizations in the nation, started in 1909 by leaders like W.E.B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, and a number of white allies. In Minnesota and in Minneapolis specifically, we have been serving the Minneapolis community since 1914, advocating for the equal rights and equal treatment of all Minneapolis residents. So I wanted to begin just also by reaffirming what Chair Mariani said earlier, that our work is not done. And I say our work because I see what the Minneapolis NAACP and what community does in relationship with the work that you do. What I love about our democracy and our constitution is that everyone is deserving of and has inherently certain rights, and that our laws reflect our values. It is the work of the Minneapolis NAACP, and I believe the work of our elected representatives, to make sure that our laws reflect our values. Our community has for decades asked for major changes and systemic changes and accountability for the police departments and policing entities of this state. And we noted the unjust treatment of not just Black, you know, residents and Black citizens in this state, but the unjust treatment by police officers of all of the citizens of Minnesota and all of the people that live here. So we are, you know, coming to you again to ask for increased accountability and increased you know, transparency when it comes to not just the police officers, but also once things happen within these policing entities and the police department, that it can be relayed accurately and transparently to community members, and so that accountability can really start to form. So what the Chair Mariani said earlier was how the community doesn't have a lack of trust within the police. And one of the things around that is that we've seen that there are definitely certain police officers who carry themselves in an untrustworthy way. So it is really crucial that as we're going to increase trust, community trust in policing, it is coupled with this accountability, because that accountability is such a large part of our values. Transparency and honesty is such a large part of our values. And so when We came last year and the year before to talk about the powder keg that you are creating by allowing the legitimacy of law in our communities to be threatened by rogue and unaccountable police officers. We are asking now again for that accountability. We ask for accountability before things exploded. And much of you all, without a non-white experience, refuse to step out the members. And then the uprising came. And I would like to also note, particularly since it was earlier, about how white supremacists burned our community this summer. White supremacists burned our community this summer. The supermarkets shut down, and the desperate and depraved looted and left our community and many of your speech. Again, on the way that we honor, that we honor MLK and his legacy. And we ask for you to honor his legacy by listening to the voices of those who are explicitly impacted by police brutality. Listen to the voices of those who have the least, who have experienced police violence. Families, listen to those who have lost someone to police violence. So, the Posse Caucus tried their best this summer to put forward legislation that reflected the requests of our community. Those requests, a lot of them, yes, they were able through bipartisan support. Some of them were able to be put through, but there's still work to be done. There's work on our side as community members, and there's work on the policy maker's side as well. And even their thoughtful, moderate reforms in a lot of ways were rejected straight down the bipartisan, straight down partisan line. Racism isn't partisan, and preventing police from harassing, beating, and killing not just Black people, but disproportionately Black people shouldn't be partisan. So again, we came here to warn you, and we come here again to warn you all that this state is allowing our city to deny us and allowing our laws to deny us equal treatment under the law. Human rights in the state of Minnesota should not be subject to local jurisdiction. Our city is failing to protect its Black citizens, and it is your duty as a legislature to ensure that we get rights guaranteed us by the U.S. and Minnesota Constitution. This is not a luxury of yours. It is a requirement, because it is also your constituents that are being impacted by police violence. This is not just a metro area issue. This is not just a Minneapolis issue. It is an issue in rural Minnesota, and it is an issue not just for Black folk in Minnesota, but for all communities. Because when one part of our community hurts, everybody hurts. So the first step would be to support the Posse reforms and other reforms that we'll be bringing forth. For if we don't, we lose not just the trust, the lack of trust that we see in the police, that those community members will lose that trust in you. It's the system that we all need, that we all have and want to buy into and abide to protect all of the people and residents in Minnesota. We do not move forward to hold police accountable. It is not just the police that people will not trust. It will also be those in powerful positions and positions of power that still continue to let the police brutalize us. So once again, thank you so much for having me. These issues are not just in Minneapolis. They are not just for Black Minneapolis residents. This is all across our state. And I want to also hark on this notion of white supremacy. What only mean carrying a KKK Ku Klux Klan card, okay? supremacy is here in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, and it is here in a way that has actually changed reality for certain folks to believe the misinformation that they have been taught to believe. And with that, they are also endangering our democracy and endangering not just Black folk in Minnesota, but all Minnesotans. So it is really crucial that we root out white supremacy, not just in, you know, the police department, but in all forms of our state and government. But I just want to recognize that white supremacy creates history realities. We see this erasure of, you know, even the Native folk who are here on this land before us. We see that through the erasure of the Black folk who have been here for, you know, decades in Minnesota. And we're seeing that right now. So I just want to note that it, when we're dealing with and we're talking rooting out white supremacy, it doesn't always mean rooting out the white supremacist. There are systemic changes that we needed that are rooted in white supremacy that we need to change right now as well. So it's moving from being just not a racist to being anti-racist. And we need right now. So thank you for your time, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Myers, and thank you to the NAACP. Racism isn't partisan. I'm struck by your framing of that. I also hear the appropriate challenge that it's not the luxury of the state to enforce human rights. It's actually our requirement that we do that. And I do think that this conversation, this understanding of how do we especially address the systemic, that is what we do as state legislators. And I think it's important that we stay rooted in understanding how systems work and that our work is to shape laws that reinforce systems that honor and advance and protect human rights. With that, members, we're going to move on to Justin Terrell, Minnesota Justice Research Center. Justin Terrell, welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Greetings, everyone, Vice Chair Fraser, Representative Johnson, and others, staff. Thank you for having me. This has been a very nice break from my normal day to hear the reports that I've heard today. And I just want to say thank you for the continued work that the members of this committee continue to do on this topic. Just a quick update. When I last testified in front of this committee, I was the executive director of the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. And since then, I've moved on from the state, and I'm currently the executive director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. And our focus at the Minnesota Justice Research Center is transforming our justice system through research, education, and policy development. We help our community create a criminal justice system. Our goal is to help our community create a criminal justice system that aligns with our commonly held values. We monitor research, we analyze what's happening in our justice system and its impact, and identify and clarify the community values and goals that will measure the effectiveness of the criminal justice policies and practices. Our work includes community-led research, guided by our research advisory board and research and evaluation services for government entities and community organizations. I'm still practicing my rap. I'm still a new executive director, so I appreciate that opportunity. And I will just say that most of what I was gonna say in my presentation has been covered today. We all know that the murder of George Floyd sparked outrage and took our state to the center stage of the globe, where people got to see firsthand the racial disparities and pain that we live with every day in the state of Minnesota. But I will say that, you know, people often ask me why Minnesota, why do I stay in Minnesota? And I'll tell you why, because in the face of that tragedy, our legislature, our commissioner of human rights, our governor, leadership, you guys had a hard time doing it, but you took action. You took bipartisan action. And, you know, the human rights investigation made sure that before George Floyd was, his body was laid in the ground, that we had chokehold restraints in the city of Minneapolis. And we had an agreement between the community and the police department that put in place restrictions, to a temporary protection order. I also want to say that the bipartisan reforms that came over the summer, you know, I spent that whole summer, you know, I hosted Governor Walz and Senator Gazelka at the George Floyd Square in the community, where we had hard conversations about justice. And we talked about the need and to respond to what the community was dealing with, because like folks said before me, police brutality and police violence is not a Black issue. It is a Minnesota issue. And that is why it is so effective and so wonderful that we see folks in this body and the leadership in the Post Board come together to do things like ban warrior training, to add more community voices to the discussion, to make sure that we are collecting data, right, so that we can track patterns of behavior. All of these things, I just want to give credit to this body for doing the hard work of pulling this together. And we all know what I'm going to say next, is that we still have much, much more work to do. The reality is we need to take a hard look, y'all. We don't have a justice system. We have a crime and punishment system. People have heard me say that before, and I'll continue to say it. It's a system that protects the profits and property of the wealthy, which people, very smart people like Dr. Alexis Harris and Dr. Chris Ugin have led conversations about how the justice system profits off of the poor and low-income communities of color. And we have a system that divides and controls the rest of us. Minnesotans deserve a justice system they can trust. According to the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, before I left there, we did a poll with the Othering and Belonging Institute out of UC Berkeley that talked about where Black people feel comfortable, safe at in our state. The fact that 50% of African Americans don't feel like they can trust the police all the time. And here's what happens when we lose trust in our policing. And I'll close up quickly here. I see that time is short. I mentor a young man who lives in North Minneapolis, and this weekend he called me after one of his friends was murdered, and he had been up all night stressing about it. And the reality is that this wasn't the first friend of his that had been murdered. This is the 11th friend of his that had been murdered this year. And why is that? It's because we have a system of policing that has lost the trust of the community. That we can no longer, that people feel like officers don't even trust each other to do the work right now and are leaving the force at a high level because they can't handle the pressure community has put on them, which then leaves a vacuum, a void, where the authority we have given to this body that has let this authority be abused over time is no longer in a position to offer the minimal protection that it was offering in the first place. And so I want to make sure that this isn't like a blame game, because the reality is that we're all in this together. But I want to make sure that we understand that the cause for justice, the cause for accountability, that all of this needs to be centered in the fact that this young man is losing friends. They're gone. These people's lives are over. And we have to come together and continue to wrestle with future reforms to make sure that we can stop that from happening. And policing isn't the only solution. We need to make investments in community. We need to do a lot of things. But I'll close by saying this. Just consider us a partner, Chair Mariani. Consider the Minnesota Justice Research Center a partner. We do research, program evaluation. We lead powerful conversations like the conference you joined us this past November with, where we got to have a bipartisan discussion with Mitch Perlstein and Mark Levin and yourself and other leaders on these topics. And we can help develop policy that look into issues like the white supremacy issue. At the end of the day, we need a North Star plan for the state of Minnesota. And I hope that you can count us as an ally to work with both sides of the aisle to help come up with real solutions, put data behind shared values, and keep the progress moving forward. Thank you so much. And I see we're at time, so my apologies if I took too long.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Thank you for the work of the Justice Resource Center. And I'm so glad that you're there to provide leadership. The stakes are indeed very high. And I think we, you know, if we can just slow down a bit, I think We all sides of the aisle and community out to law enforcement, I think we're pretty much saying the same thing. We just got to pull it together and believe and trust and push each other. And I think we can do that. Finally, we're going to hear from Julia Decker from the ACLU of Minnesota. We're going to go over a little bit, members, but hopefully not too much. And we'll adjourn immediately afterwards, after Julia's Decker's presentation. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I...
Oh, you got muted.
I have timed my testimony, so it should be about 3 minutes. Mr. Okay. Chair, is this better?
Yes.
Okay, I'll turn off my video. My internet connection is a little bad. I apologize. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Julia Decker. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. The ACLU of Minnesota is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We advocate in the courts, in the community, and here at the legislature to protect, defend, and realize civil liberties for all Minnesotans. Policing and public safety are undoubtedly at the forefront of this committee's minds and the minds of many Minnesotans and many Americans. Over the summer, we were pleased that the legislature responded rapidly to the murder of George Floyd with state-level proposals. But as others have said, we want to be clear that the work this body began in special session is far from finished. Changes such as allowing residency incentives, imposing a duty to intercede, increasing community input at the post board, these address symptoms. But it really is the underlying systems of policing and public safety that require change. Too often, the policy response to police violence has been to try and build safeguards against a repeat of an incident that has already happened. So when police use lethal force against a person suffering a mental health crisis, the legislative response is to fund more mental health training for peace officers. When George Floyd died with a police officer's knee on his neck, the legislative response was to restrict future use of that type of restraint. This after the fact policymaking has not worked. If it had, George Floyd and many others would still be alive today. Moreover, it doesn't address the deep-rooted systemic problems that have survived each and every one of these attempts at change. So over the summer, we at the ACLU of Minnesota advocated for stronger provisions in the policing bill, and we will continue to do so this session and beyond. We want to see actual accountability implemented via creation of a state cause of action for civil rights violations by government employees such as police officers. Creating this state path for liability lifts the shield of qualified immunity that has systematically prevented accountability for harms that are disproportionately suffered by Minnesota's communities of color. We'll advocate for bans on invasive and dangerously inaccurate surveillance technologies such as facial recognition technology. And we want oversight and transparency mechanisms enacted so that other surveillance technologies, both existing and in the future, can't be deployed in secret without public notice or examination and with guardrails against infringement on civil liberties. We'll continue to advocate for increased independent oversight and review of law enforcement officers and their conduct. Law enforcement has the power to deprive Minnesotans of life, and this extraordinary power on behalf of the state demands heightened independent scrutiny. We want to see the barrier to empowered civilian oversight boards lifted because policing is inherently local, and so local governing bodies should not be prevented from having full discussions and conversations about civilian oversight boards and their authority. We also want to see an independent prosecutor's office for cases involving officer-caused deaths and harms. We'll continue advocating for stricter limits on officer use of force and use of deadly force, and increased reporting and public access to that reporting. We'll continue to advocate for separation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. We'll advocate for systems of fines and fees and asset forfeiture that reduce profit motives in policing and increase equity and access to justice. And finally, we'll continue advocating for a reimagining of public safety overall that invests not just in law enforcement budgets, but in housing, mental health care, substance use treatment, and other issues at the root of public safety for all Minnesotans. So thank you very much for staying over, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. I'm informed that we do need to run. Thank you for your testimony and for the work of the ACLU members. We'll be meeting next Tuesday. We're going to hear the task force report on Minnesota's murdered Indigenous women, and also a testimony on a U visa certification bill being authored by Representative Feist. Until that time, members, this committee stands adjourned.